Chapter 14. Professor Fitch, Melody read from the paper, is a little squirrel of a man, huddled before his books like they were the winter's nuts, piled and packed carelessly in his den. He's deceptively important, for he is at the center of the search to find the Armedius killer. Killer? Joel asked. Melody held up a finger, still reading. Or at least, that's what one source speculates. Yes, we fear for the lives of the kidnapped students, the unnamed source said. Every officer knows that if someone goes missing this conspicuously, chances are good that they'll never be found. At least, not alive. Professor Fitch is more optimistic. He not only thinks that the children are still alive, but that they can be recovered. And the secret to their whereabouts might have to do with the discovery of some strange rhythmic lines discovered at the crime scenes. We don't know what they are or what they do, Professor Fitch explained, but those lines are definitely involved. He declined to show me these drawings, but he did indicate that they weren't composed of any of the four basic lines. Fitch is a humble man, Melody continued reading. He speaks with a quiet, unassuming voice. Few would realize that upon him our hopes must rest. For if there really is a arithmetist madman on the loose in New Britannia, then it will undoubtedly take arithmetist to defeat him. She looked up from the paper, their empty ice cream dishes and soda glasses sitting dirty on the table. The parlor was growing less busy as many of the students left for Armedius to make curfew. Well, I guess now you know the whole of it, Joel said. That's it, she said. That's all you were talking about with the inspector? That's pretty much it. The article contained some frightening details, such as the exact nature of Lily's and Herman's disappearances, including the fact that blood was found at each scene. This is bad, Melody. I can't believe that got printed. Why? Up until now, the police and Principal York were still implying that Herman and Lily might have just run away. Parents of arithmetists at the academy guessed otherwise, but the people of the city didn't know. Well, it's best for them to know the truth, then, Melody proclaimed. Even if it causes panic? Even if ordinary people hide in their homes because they're afraid of a killer who may not exist and who undoubtedly isn't going to hurt them? Melody bit her lip. Joel sighed, standing. Let's get back, he said, folding up a newspaper. We have to make curfew, and I want to get this to Inspector Harding just in case he hasn't seen it yet. She nodded, joining Joel as he walked out onto the street. It felt darker now, and Joel again wondered at the wisdom of going out when there was a killer about. Melody seemed to be in a similar mood, and she walked closer to him than she had before. Their steps were quick, their conversation non-existent, until they finally arrived back at the gates to Armedius. The same two officers stood at the entryway. As Joel entered, the campus clock beat 15 minutes to the hour. "Where is Inspector Harding?" Joel asked.
"Out, I'm afraid," one of the men said. "Is there something we can help you with?"
"Give him this when he gets back in," Joel said, handing one of them the paper. The officer scanned it, his face growing troubled. "Come on," Joel said to Melody. "I'll walk you back to your dorm." "Well," she said, "aren't you chivalrous all of a sudden?" They strolled down the path, Joel lost in thought. At least the article hadn't been belittling of Fitch. Perhaps the reporter had felt guilty for lying to him. They reached the dormitory. "Thank you for the ice cream," Joel said.
"No, thank you."
"You paid for it," he said, "even if you gave me the money first."
"I wasn't thanking you for paying,"
Melody said airily, pulling open the door to the dormitory.
"For what, then?" he asked.
"For not ignoring me," she said. "But at the same time, for ignoring the fact that I'm kind of a freak sometimes."
"We're all freaks sometimes, Melody," he replied. "You're just, well, better at it than most." She raised an eyebrow.
"Very flattering."
"That didn't come out as I meant it."
"I'll have to forgive you then," she said. "How boring. Good night, Joel."
She vanished into the dormitory,
door closing behind her. He slowly crossed the lawn, his thoughts a jumble, and found himself wandering around the arithmetic campus. He knew where most of the professors lived, so it was easy for him to determine which previously unused office probably housed Nalazar. Sure enough, he soon found the door bearing Nalazar's nameplate resting on the outside wall of Making Hall. Joel loitered outside the hall, looking up at the dark second floor. Making Hall was the newest of the four and had a lot more windows than the older ones. The windows of Nalazar's rooms were dark. Did that mean he wasn't in, or that he'd retired already?
Melody said that Nalazar wanted the books delivered to his office. They're probably sitting on his desk, or maybe waiting at the top of the stairwell.
Joel found himself reaching for the doorknob. He stopped himself. What am I doing? Was he really considering breaking into the professor's office? He needed to think before trying something so drastic. He walked away across the lawn. As he did, he heard something and turned. The door to Nalazar's stairwell opened, and a figure with a dark cloak and blonde hair stepped out. Nalazar himself. Joel felt his heart leap, but he was standing far enough away and shattered enough in darkness that Nalazar didn't notice him. The professor put on a top hat and strode off down the sidewalk. Joel felt his heart beating in his chest. If he had gone up those stairs, Nalazar would have caught him for sure. He took a few deep breaths, calming himself. Then he realized that now he knew for certain that the professor was gone. And if he returns quickly, Joel thought. He shook his head. If he did decide to sneak into the professor's room, he'd need to have more of a plan. He kept moving, but didn't feel like going home. He was too awake. Eventually, he decided on a different course of action. There was someone he knew would be up late this night, someone he could talk to. He knew all the normal places to check for his mother, and he tried those first. He didn't find her, but he did find Darm, one of the other cleaning ladies. She sent him to the right place. It turned out that his mother was cleaning the dueling arena. Joel walked up to the door, which was propped open slightly, and peeked in. He heard the sounds of scrubbing echoing inside, so he pulled open the door and slipped in. The dueling chamber was in the middle of Making Hall and took up most of the central space in the building. The room's ceiling was of glass squares with iron supports between. Arithmetic duels, after all, were best watched from above. During the melee, professors and local dignitaries watched from the best seats up there. Joel had never seen that room, though he had been lucky enough to get a lower seat for a couple of the melees. The room was shaped like an ice skating rink. There was the playing field floor below, black so that chalk would show up well on it, with enough space for dozens of people to draw defensive circles at once. Seats ran around the outside, though there weren't ever enough for all the people who wanted to attend the melee. There were dueling competitions throughout the year, of course. The melee, however, was the most popular. It was the last chance for the juniors to show off their skill before they were shipped to Nebraska for their last year of training. Winners in the melee were given important posts in Nebraska, and would have a much better chance of becoming squad leaders and captains. Joel's mother crouched on hands and knees in the middle of the room, scrubbing at the black rock floor, a single spring-work lantern beside her. She wore her hair tied back with a kerchief, her sleeves rolled up, her brown skirt dusty from crawling around. Joel felt a sudden stab of anger. Other people went to plays, lounged in their rooms, or slept while his mother scrubbed floors. The anger immediately turned to guilt. While his mother scrubbed floors, he had been eating ice cream. If I were an arithmetist, he thought, she wouldn't have to do this. Melody had spoken with disdain about the money and power many arithmetists coveted. She obviously had no concept of what it was like to have to go without. Joel walked down the steps between the bleachers, his steps echoing. His mother looked up. "Joel?" she said as he stepped onto the black rock floor.
You should be getting ready for bed, young man.
I'm not tired, he said, joining her and picking up the extra brush floating in her bucket.
What are we doing? Scrubbing the floor?
She eyed him for a moment. Finally, she turned back to her work. She was far more lax with his sleep habits in the summer.
Don't ruin your trousers, she said. The floor has a rough texture. If you aren't careful, you'll scuff your knees and fray the cloth.
Joel nodded and began to work on a section that she hadn't yet scrubbed.
Why do we need to clean this place? It doesn't get used that often.
It has to look good for the melee, Joel, she said, brushing a stray lock of hair away from her face and tucking it behind her ear.
We have to apply a finish each year to keep the color dark. The playing field needs to be clean before we can do that.
Joel nodded, scrubbing. It felt good to be active rather than just sorting through books.
That girl seemed nice, his mother said.
Who, Melody?
No, the other girl you brought over for dinner.
Joel blushed.
Yeah, I suppose. She's a bit strange.
Arithmetists often are, his mother said.
I'm glad to see you with the girl, though. I worry about you. You always seem to have people to talk to, but you don't go out in the evenings. You have a lot of acquaintances, not a lot of friends.
You've never said anything, she snorted.
One doesn't have to be a professor to know that teenage boys don't like hearing about their mother's worries.
Joel smiled. You have it easy with me. As teenage sons go, I'm not much of a headache. They continued to work for a time, Joel still feeling annoyed that his mother should have to do such hard work. Yes, arithmetists were important. They helped protect the Isles from the dangers in Nebraska. Yet wasn't what his mother did important as well? The master chose arithmetists. Didn't he, in a way, choose cleaning ladies as well? Why was it that people valued what his mother did so much less than what someone like Professor Fitch did? She worked twice as hard as anyone Joel knew, and yet she gained no notoriety, no wealth or prestige. Melody had wondered where his mother's money went, and it was a good question. His mother worked long hours, so where did their money go? Was his mother saving it all? Or was there something else? An expense Joel had never considered. He sat upright, feeling a chill. The principal didn't really give me free admittance to Armedius, did he? That's just what you tell me, to keep me from feeling guilty. You're paying for me to go here.
What?
His mother asked, still scrubbing.
I could never afford that.
Mother, you work double shifts most days. That money has to be going somewhere. She snorted.
Even with double shifts, I couldn't afford this place. Do you have any idea how much in tuition most of those parents pay?
Joel thought for a moment, remembering that Melody had spoken of a student who got $10 a week in allowance. If that much was simple spending money, then how much were they paying for the students to go to Armedius? Joel didn't want to know.
So where does it go? He asked. Why work all these extra hours?
She didn't look up.
Your father left more than a family behind when he died, Joel.
What does that mean?
We have debts, she said, continuing to scrub. It's really nothing for you to worry about.
Father was a chalkmaker, Joel said. His workroom was provided by the school, as were his materials.
Where did he get debts?
From a lot of different things, she said, scrubbing a little bit harder.
He traveled a lot, meeting with arithmetists and talking about their work. The spring rail wasn't as cheap then as it is now. Plus, there were the books, the supplies, the time off to work on his various projects. He got some from Principal York, but he got the greater part from outside sources. The type of men who would lend money to a poor craftsman like your father, well, they aren't the kind of men you can ignore when they come asking for payment.
How much?
It doesn't matter to you.
I want to know. His mother glanced at him, meeting his eyes.
This is my burden, Joel. I'm not going to have it ruining your life. You'll be able to start fresh and clean with a good education, thanks to Principal York. I'll deal with your father's problems."
Obviously, she considered that the end of the conversation. She turned back to her scrubbing.
"What did Father spend all that time working on?" Joel asked, attacking a section of floor. "He must have believed in it a lot if he was willing to risk so much."
"I didn't understand a lot of his theories," she said. "You know how he would go on, talking about chalk composition percentages. He thought he was going to change the world with his chalk. I believed in him. Master, help me."
The room fell silent, save for the sound of brushes against stone.
"It was his goal to send you to Armedius, you know," she said softly. "He wanted to be able to afford to send you here, to study. I think that's why Principal York gave you the scholarship."
"Is that why you always get so mad at me for not doing well in my classes?"
"That's part of it. Oh, Joel, don't you see? I just want you to have a better life than we did. Your father, he sacrificed so much.
He might have made it, too, if his blasted research hadn't ended up costing his life."
Joel cocked his head.
"He got wounded in a spring rail accident."
She paused.
"Yes, that's what I meant. If he hadn't been out traveling on one of his projects, he wouldn't have been on the train when it derailed."
Joel eyed her.
"Mother," he said, "Father did die from a spring rail accident, didn't he? You saw him in the hospital, Joel. You sat with him while he died."
Joel frowned, but couldn't dispute that fact. He remembered the sterile rooms, the physicians bustling about, the medications they gave his father, and the surgeries they did on his crushed legs. Joel also remembered the forced optimism they'd all displayed when telling Joel that his father would get better. They'd known he would die. Joel could see it now. They'd all known, even his mother. Only the 8-year-old Joel had hoped, thinking, no, knowing, that his father would eventually wake up and be just fine. The accident had happened the 3rd of July. Joel had spent the 4th, the day of inception, at his father's side. His stomach twisted inside. He'd held his father's hand as he died.